Yo, how's it going, folks? Welcome to episode 143. I think I did that the first time. My fingers barely got into that gesture, but we did it. Hope you had a wonderful 420 and bicycle day for those that partake out there, for our psychedelic brethren and sisters, of course. 420 Durham. Durham, we had a first event in like 6 years. Went off without a hitch. Went off without a hitch, not gonna lie. I kind of was worried that we might have a problem. We had no problems. The police were not only were excellent with us, they contacted us prior to thank us for our contacting them with details of what we were planning to do. We now have our own protest liaison team officer who happens to be the head of the division. So we'll be meeting with them in the next few weeks to discuss future events down at what we colloquially term, obviously, Hemp Gardens. It was a very interesting event. A couple hundred people over the day. Obviously, I know some people were slightly disappointed we didn't have stalls. Obviously, we've been absent for 6 years, folks. We can't suddenly go back to 20 vendors in the middle of a public space while cannabis is still the schedule one in this country. We are obviously seeking to rebuild those relationships and to be able to facilitate that in the future. So watch this space. All right, I'm going to jump straight on, introduce you to today's guest because I am eager to have this conversation because we've just, we had quite a preamble of a discussion, which I'm slightly frustrated is not going to be in the recording, but I think we can replicate it in the coming hour or two. Let's jump straight into introducing today's guest, who is an industrial hemp developer, a cannabis entrepreneur, founder of the Hera Group, director of the Jack Hera Foundation, and the son of legendary cannabis activist Jack Hera. They are his second son, Dan Hera. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Very welcome, very welcome. I'm glad we could get this together.
Yeah, no, this is good.
Indeed, indeed. As we were sort of chatting about in the preamble there, we met, I think, about 5 years ago. We were sat on a stage together at the Hemp and CBD Expo in Birmingham. And wow, a lot has changed in those 6 years, brother. A lot has gone down on both sides of the Atlantic. But before we jump into kind of our gripes and our grief with the state of legalization or of the cannabis industry around the world, let's go in with a bit of a chronological sort of order here for people that may not know. But how and f bleh, try that again. How and when did you first get involved with cannabis?
Really, it was because my father found cannabis when he was 30. We started getting exposed to it in the early 70s, as his sons. And from that point on, it was just part of our family's existence. My father became a very well-known cannabis freedom fighter and activist, and then author. And we as a family went along on that ride, from making paraphernalia for, smoke shops back in the 70s and 80s, to owning the smoke shops, to, registering voters to vote and getting signatures on petitions to legalize cannabis since we were old enough to be legally able to collect those signatures. So from a young adult, 18 years old, up through, the mid-aughts, as many forms of potential legalization offers came across the balloting side of cannabis in the United States, and especially here in California for us. We were a part of it.
Yeah, man. So I guess literally, my next question here, for a lot of people that I speak, in fact, every guest I think that I've spoken to thus far, their story is almost they discover cannabis in secret and they have to hide it from their parents. So what was it like? Like, I'm not saying was Jack kind of like, throwing joints at you? Like, what kind of, or were you all kind of aware of his? Because anyone that saw him speak or sees any clip or reads any of his work can attest to the passion of the man. So I'm just kind of wondering, what was it like sort of behind closed doors? Were you all kind of aware that, were you on board automatically, or was, it just, that's what this house, we're a cannabis house.
Well, we didn't have any real, you know, overwhelming preconception, you know, as young, you know, young kids, you know, when my dad discovered cannabis in 1969, but I didn't really become aware of my father's interactions with the plant until like 1971, 72. And it was shortly after that, you know, my brothers and I, you know, we started, you know, making certain accessories for, you know, head shops back in the 70s, which continued on for, you know, nearly 20 years. And it just seemed normal. So there wasn't any transition. Once we started understanding what cannabis was, we became very popular with our friends, you know, but even then, it was, you know, we socially, outside of our circles, you know, we weren't outwardly, cannabis, you know, the way that we are today. It was still something that, you know, we could have gotten a lot of trouble, you know, as a family back in the 70s and 80s. But that really didn't seem, it was absolutely normal. It was like getting up and making breakfast. It was not something that he, you know, put joints in front of us, asked if we wanted to smoke. I don't think any one of us really indulged with our dad for many, many years after we had started smoking. You know, and even then we didn't really include him on it, you know? And so, you know, we had our experience with discovering cannabis, and, you know, as we became, you know, mid-teens, we had a more open relationship with our dad with regards to, you know, smoking, him knowing we were smoking, and even smoking together in our teens.
No, that's lovely. Yeah, you still, obviously, you're such an avid activist. Obviously, gained more sort of national attention, sort of later into later 70s, 80s, especially obviously post 85 and the release of The Emperor Wears No Clothes. But it's lovely that you still had your own kind of authentic experience, and I can kind of almost imagine you and your brothers smoking it, still hiding it. And even if your dad's Jack Herer, still being like, ah, it's still our dad. He's not cool. He's not cool enough to smoke with us.
No, it was never that, because there was never something that we felt that we had to hide, because it was so open. There wasn't any sense of shame. You know, there wasn't any, you know, we shouldn't, you know, discuss, we shouldn't share, we shouldn't experience. There wasn't any of that we really had to go through. I think more the stigma was when friends' parents found out that, you know, my father was an activist, or we smoked pot when we were in junior high and high school, that, you know, they would sort of not want their kids to hang out with us because of their perception of what they thought cannabis was. And I think it was our friends that really continued that charade of, you know, I'm good kids, when, you know, when they left their parents' house, you know. Many of them were, I would say, more into drinking alcohol still at 16 and 17 years old back then than they were smoking cannabis. Because alcohol seemed to be far easier to get.
I suppose the quintessential prohibitionists will then be saying that, well, this must mean that you and your siblings must have all suffered with addiction issues. Were you all drinking at a young age? Were you all taking all of these drugs? So I'm curious. Obviously, I'm being a bit of a dick there for comedic sense, but like, I am curious if then, like, I imagine you will have obviously disproven that, but I'm curious as to know, like, your own experiences kind of with alcohol and other things. Like, was it this thing? Did you have kind of this youthful exuberance and naivety that, well, if cannabis is cannabis, everything else is everything. Do you know what I mean? Or am I missing a quote?
Yeah, you know, I never really looked at it like, you know, if cannabis was this much fun and it's not as bad as we were trying to be taught in school, then alcohol and all these other things must not be bad either. It's not to say that we didn't experiment. I know that I experimented with, you know, multiple different substances growing up, but none of them were ever part of my life, nor are they part of my life today. You know, I rarely drink. I don't really consume a lot of cannabis these days as much as I did when I was younger. I've never been a drinker, and I've never really had the addiction to substances other than food, you know. So I just don't have that. And you know, it's not to say that my family hasn't experienced the use of different, you know, things over the years, but you know, today, you know, none of us are real, you know, heavy consumers of anything. It's just a part of life. It's like, you know, waking up, you know, having a cup of coffee for me. It's pretty normal. I don't smoke on the daily. In fact, you know, sometimes I go, you know, months or longer without any consumption. But it really just, for me, it just depends on the moment or the mood. And, you know, it's just a part of life. It's not life itself, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't have that presence in my life other than the fact that my father's name is represented within the cannabis space, the company that, you know, that I try to manage and build and expand is based on products, whether they're hemp clothing or hemp products or, you know, cannabis THC products. It's just, you know, it's part of what our family represents. My father's name represents. And it's just a matter of, you know, staying focused on trying to control the use of my father's name and commerce as this becomes something that's come out of the gray and out into the light and has become a, you know, a consumer package good. We're hoping that we're able to control the name Jack Herer in that space.
Yeah, well, I think it's different to for my own legal protection, I'm not going to allude to which other brands that I'm thinking of, but it's different to other brands and spaces where basically somebody who has passed prior to kind of this new world that we're in of what I call it neo-legalization, but for this sake, we'll call it legalization. This co-opting by commercial investor capital, and it loses the authenticity that it stood for. Whereas yourself, I mean, as I said, Jack had several children, you know, he's very much, the name is still alive. It's still a living entity and it's still affected. It's not this sort of dusted off relic. You know, the book is still being, I think it's what, 13th edition now, 12th edition, 13th, something like that.
I think we're on 14th.
14, see, they just keep it going and going and going. And
and six that, languages.
Yeah. And it is a totem. It is almost, if you want to look at legacy culture as a religion, it is our Bible. That's what it has become to stand. I mean, many people have risen further of, like, you've got Ed Rosenthal, you've got, you know, I think, you know, Martin Booth wrote an incredible book on cannabis. You know, several people have written books, but what Jack put together, it speaks, it's the full thing. And it's seeing it not compartmentalized, but in the ubiquitous utility of it in every facet of our lives. And I think that that's something that you seem to be carrying on, as you say, with the diversifying for all, again, I'll disagree with the words of hemp. It's all cannabis to me, baby. But the fact that you're showing all of the applications and you're brandizing them in a way that honors the legacy. It's not like, if you guys, I don't know if you do, I might get to embarrass myself, but if you guys suddenly start chucking out HHC or whatever, that's kind of not where, I don't think your dad was going with stuff. I may be wrong, but that's maybe my interpretation of, you know, get the natural thing dealt with first, you know, unrestrict and allow it. And cannabis will show you where it can go. Whereas if you try and put it into places for all to weed, she might not choose to grow. And I think that's what we're kind of seeing at the minute, is this juxtaposition between the intention of the plant and the people that have protected it, the ego, the legacy culture, and these people that are seeking to profiteer from it or create a social cachet. And look, my joint's bigger than your joint. We don't smoke the same. I've paid more for my weed. Mine's more exclusive. All of these ego games on the other side of this neo culture that we're seeing, you know, and I can't help but feel like the plants sat in the middle, like, y'all are fucking dying. Your waters are toxic, your deforestation, desertification, you got microplastics, you know, you got the fuels, all of these products, and we're bickering over the facade of this, you know, who gets ownership, who gets to look cool and be the cool kid. And it's like, nah, man, make cannabis boring. I don't want to be, I love what I do, but I don't want to be sat here in 20 years still being like, dudes, just grow it on curbs. Just grow it wild. It sequesters all the carbon. Let's not be charging 10 or a gram. Like, I sound like I'm a little bit anti-capitalist, but I truly believe that cannabis is, as my friend Trev Coleman says, it is a capitalist resource with a socialist agenda. That the more cannabis becomes commercialized, look at what happened in, is it Pueblo County in Colorado? And the reversal that they had as one of the first territories that benefited from legalization in Colorado. And they started putting hundreds of people through higher education. They started paying for secondary education. They started paying for potholes. They suddenly started having all of this extra money that they were putting into various services. And then people were obviously given an opportunity to participate in the industry. Obviously, things have got a little bit Wild West since then, although some would argue that was the Wild West, but that's regulators for you. I'm looking for a question in this waffle here, Dan. I'm sorry. I'm just going to chuck it over to you.
No, but I think, you know, the power of my father's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, you know, with all of the other great books that have been written on how to grow, how to develop seeds, there wasn't really anything out there that was the story of us or how we became or why we were where we found ourselves. Mm-hmm. And my father's book was sort of that catalyst, because it brought all of this information all out at once that was so, you know, absurd, because it was so contrary to everything that we had learned as adults, as children, and as business entrepreneurs, that how did all of these things used to be made from cannabis, from, you know, clothing to lamp oil to, medicines to everything that was part of our everyday existence. How were all of these things made from cannabis, yet none of us knew about it? And my father's book sort of opened up that box and said, look, when you're using cannabis to its full utility, all things are possible. You know, changing the narrative on the world's climate is potentially there, as long as we will allow it to be there. You know, and like he said, you know, he wasn't saying that hemp was going to save the world, but it was the only thing that he felt that could. And that's because it touches every part of how we live in this human experience. You know, whether it's the plastic that comes in and out of our lives, whether it's the clothing that we wear, whether it's medicine or food, whether it's health supplementals, whether it's, feed for the animals on farms, you know, materials to build our homes, fuels for our cars, all of these different things can be impacted by the embracing of this plant. And I think that for what the book was at its time, I think it's probably more relevant today than it was in 1985. Because today we have the technologies in order to really explore the different possibilities that cannabis can be and can become and can be utilized within our lives, where before, when he was writing, it was theorized because the technologies didn't exist, but you knew that it had some of the same elements. So, to be able to, for my father to be able to see that is so far in advance. Like, if you could embrace this, how much better would our lives be? And today we have the ability to actually execute on that. And I think that that scares the industrial world in a way that the fuckery that is going on now within the compliance and regulation space of access to cannabis or hemp or CBD or extracted molecules or, you know, the different things that are part of cannabis. I think that the technology that is within this plant is so disruptive that it changes the profiles potentially of all of these mega corporations that are extracting, you know, hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars out of our economy every decade or two through the products that they make currently, making their products from non-renewable, you know, devastatingly poisonous, you know, substances. And that they could all be replaced by this one plant that could be grown by anybody, by you, by me. And, you know, how dare you be able to plant a seed in the ground and grow your own health and well-being and sustainability. And, you know, the way that the world works today is, you know, that only comes with a pound of flesh. Mm-hmm. You know, if, you know, they don't want a farmer to be able to grow a voice, to grow power, to grow wealth and influence by being able to put a plant in the ground and water it and change the world. They want to be the ones that control the world. So therefore, the only way they control us is by regulating us, our access to the plant and the ability to expand how we're able to use it into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly that. I think it's as we were sort of discussing too in the prelude, or alluding to in the prelude and while we were discussing it. They want the world to be saved, but only if they're the ones to save it and if it doesn't come at a too high of a price. And I think the price that we're asking them to pay is the loss of monopoly of these huge international conglomerates at the heads of industries and their privilege and preference at the head of a system that has benefited them for, it's quite interesting, actually. If you look at the war on drugs and when prohibition started and the benefit of these cabals, they almost align perfectly. This isn't me saying that, you know, they're benefiting directly from the war on drugs, but, you know, if anyone wants to Google Iran-Contra and Ollie North and what was the guy who, the reporter that some were, was it Webb? I think the guy was named Webb, and he died from two self-inflicted gunshot wounds to the head. He was a reporter in LA. He covered it. Anyway, my point being that that system of, they've got so used to it. Imagine the analogy of a prison, and all of a sudden one day you're going to say, all right, we're going to let the prisoners out and they're going to live and you've got to be equal with them. Those guards have had decades of abusing them, of having this power and this control and this hyper-normalization of them bullying and abusing them and persecuting them. That's going to take a transitional period. They suddenly can't go, oh, cool, we're fine, and then step off, even if that was what's happening, but it isn't. They're saying that's what's happening while they're setting up systems. As I was speaking to a lot to they and there. What I mean by this is establishment power, investment capital, and yeah, the kind of revolving door systems between governments and corporations that seek to create a monolith of neoliberalistic sort of ideology, which we currently live under, people. But yeah, it is. It's the money, it seems to me, is what's fucking us up here. We can't see anymore. Oh, replacing plastics mean that millions of people might not die from cancers and all these other preventable illnesses. We're not looking at, oh, replacing petroleum means we don't now need all these stupid carbon credits and, you know, cameras in cities recording how many miles you drive. And it feels like they're deliberately choosing to miss the easy answer because the consequence of that easy answer is a form of socialism. Ugh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the aspects of cannabis is it is a truly social plant on so many levels, whether it's the social building within a community, whether it's how we interact with each other out in public, at concerts, at venues, at gatherings that are peaceful, non-combative, easy to patrol. That's not a narrative that looks good for those that are controlling, you know, what the public should be seeing. The public shouldn't be seeing the fact that people are really coming together and just having a good time, smoking some cannabis, enjoying commerce, whether they're selling, you know, t-shirts or hats or posters or, you know, cannabis, or, you know, that this is happening without gangs. It's happening without guns. It's happening without, hostile interactions. And that is completely contrary to the narrative that they want to paint. Because the painting of the narrative that is controlling us, all of the compliance and regulation that is becoming part of the cannabis space, is not based on what it is. It's not based on, you know, how it truly affects communities. It's based on the lies that created prohibition to begin with, you know, that it still needs to be protected. It still needs to be, regulated. It still needs to be controlled. It's still a vice for gangs and warlords and, you know, drug dealers. And it's, you know, this narrative comes with the price, and that price is freedom and access. And that's the narrative that they have to keep telling us, or telling the public, because the truth to the public would mean that these sophisticated societies has been lying to us the whole time, and they can't admit to the lie. So they have to perpetuate the false narrative. And then they break off a little piece at a time of like, oh, we're going to give you more access. We're going to give you more leeway because, you know, we have more control, and they give us, you know, maybe a little lower taxes and a little bit more scope on the products that we create based on the fact that they're making it safer for us. And so that narrative is something that desperately needs to change, but it's hard when the megaphone on the other side is controlled by so many with so much.
Indeed, indeed. That kind of neo culture is, yeah, really, they have the loudest voice and the biggest access, because everything that's become a cabal since prohibition, and kind of the go-go 80s, you know, Reaganomics and Thatcherism over here in the little UK, kind of just led to open criminality. You know, stock markets went up 1,000+%, you know, people got ungodly rich, you know, cocaine was, you know, more widely available than fucking sugar. And it was just kind of the culture and the times. And I think that's why Jack's book was so a counter to this. Do you know what I mean? It spoke of the opposite of this ego destruction and greed and outsourcing and just race to the bottom and highest margins and all the, you know, what was his name? You know, Gordon Gekko in Wall Street, you know, greed. Greed is good.
Right.
You know, greed will save this malfeasant corporation known as the United States. I can't remember the full quote. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie, but Jesus, like, that's what they are almost like trying to stoke back into power and going, cannabis is this regenerative resource. One seed, I can be a trillionaire. They're seeing the opposite of what we see. One seed saves the world. One seed creates then a plant. You clone that plant for billions of them, sequesters the carbon. It starts, you know, we see it in two different things, and we're stood at this junction. Yeah. And I think the steel man, the argument of the institutions and of power, of, you know, of governments, what I suppose is termed in America, deep state, or over here, the civil service, you kind of career people that make laws and rules beyond the politicians. To steel man their position, I think that they created a boogeyman so big, so powerful, and so scary that they have to climb. They're climbing down little by little, but they still need there to be a boogeyman, because in their head, people anarchy will happen. And like you say, I think they can't admit to the grand lie of going, actually, you know what? Everything you now know about cannabis, yeah, we knew most of that back then. You know, CBD was isolated in like the 30s. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, granted, THC wasn't until like in the 90s and the endocannabinoid system found around the same sort of time. Maybe I'm mixing up my dates. But my point is that we knew a lot about what the plant could do, because as you say, it was doing it. It was literally, it was in everything. I've recently read Jules Verne, is that his name? Jules Verne, yeah. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This book was written in 1937, I believe. And there's a passage of that, and he's talking about the underground cables that were laid from Washington to London and how the cables were so weak and fragile inside that they were breaking. So they decided to impact them and line them with cannabis fibers because it made them more rigid so they could move in the water and thus protect the cables. And again, it's just all those kind of references were either removed from us in academic or scholastic circles. You know, Nixon ordered this in the States. He was literally like, if it is in a library that we have authority over or a university that we give autonomy to, or power to, we want that destroyed. And the same that reverberated around the world. I mean, we're lucky now with the internet, a lot of information is getting digitized and we're starting, like say, we're rediscovering these things. But if a lot of it, actually, said you go to your dad's book and you go, referencing this, do you know what I mean? It's not lost knowledge. It's not new knowledge. It's lost knowledge. But we keep getting this, like the cartoon knocked on the head. We're seeing the stars and we keep forgetting about it. We come to and we just, for some reason, continue to destroy the world with single use this or, you know, PFAS and these forever chemicals or.
Well, don't forget that the single use is also a byproduct of compliance and regulation.
Yeah.
You know, we are mandated within the consumer packaged good era to create these child safety, packaging that are either one time use or there's no requirement for renewable products. There's no recycling for the cannabis industry waste at the moment, and where it's mandated that we create these products, which is a horrible disservice to both the community, the way that we process and think about how to access cannabis, and imagine going into a pastry shop, a donut shop, and every single donut was individually wrapped in some sort of protective packaging because of the dangers of diabetes and sugar that each one came with this throwaway packaging. That's basically, what cannabis is today is, it's really a horrible situation, but at the same time, everything being, compact consumer packaged goods, from a business standpoint, it allows you to build a brand, like your General Mills Foods or your, your candy or your soda or whatever, it has to be in a vessel in order for somebody to know that it's yours. Mm-hmm. And it's a truly double-edged sword that we have to fight within ourselves and sort of come to grips with this is what we have today, but we have to come up with some sort of solution in order to deal with the amount of refuse that's created that is continuing to pollute the planet when we're talking about this plant being able to save the planet. Today, we're using glass jars and plastic lids on many of the packaging for our live flower, mm-hmm. And that packaging, for a pound of flower is 28 pounds of trash to pack 1 pound of flower.
And again, like the glasses. So we use like Kilner jars and like so with the rubber seals, like glass and metal with the seal. Like,
yeah,
that's been a standard for a lot of growers for a very long time. And
most
you have them forever. And it's one of the things we did a fireside chat with Product Earth one year. There's about five or six of us, and one of the businessmen we're talking, he runs a hemp company here in the UK, or cannabis company. I'm going to use hemp for the rest of this conversation rather than just being annoying. And he basically went, oh, well, we're now getting this grant from the government doing research and development, and we're going to be producing all of this packaging. And I kind of grabbed the mic and I turned to the crowd and I went, what do you all store your cannabis in at home? And ubiquitously across the crowd, everyone, glass. Like it's the creators so all look at our innovation and our research development. And it's they're doing the right thing or the right thing in the wrong way. What am I trying to say? It's like it's the illusion of they're saying to us that look at all these innovations and developments and the thing, but they're in the wrong, say the wrong direction. That means that there's a company that's going to come in that has to produce all that packaging. Then there's another company that comes in that prints all of that. Then we have the logistics for all of that. Then we have the air freight. Then this, and it's jobs for the boys. That it's completely sort of missing the thing. I think cannabis ultimately, what I want to see, and this is going to annoy a lot, in fact, every business person out there. Sorry, guys, don't come at me. Actually, come at me in the comments below. I want to see cannabis become like wheat. I want to see it become like a vegetable. It just should be as benign as just, it should be classed, class one, two, three. You know, if you can grow to a certain thing, then, and it, there should be a universal grading system across the world. Like everyone can, you're in the onion trade, you can go to an onion farmer and you can class his onions. If it was an Italian onion, if it was a Spanish onion, if it was a Japanese onion. Do you know what I mean? It's, there's a universal nature to it. Everyone, then the pound rate will change per like the amount that you can buy it in each sort of region and jurisdictional differences. But ultimately, that's where it belongs, frankly, as far as I see it. But it doesn't mean that then buying an eighth is profitable. Like, look at tobacco. I know, obviously, here in the UK, our duty is huge. But you're getting like 30 grams for... It's been a while since I bought tobacco, quite a long time. 20 quid, I think it is nowadays. So £20 gets you like 30 grams. That's like over an ounce of tobacco for 20 quid. Whereas to buy then the ounce of weed over here, you're spending £200, tenfold. And it's you then think, what is really the difference of this crop if it was grown in... Do you get what I'm saying? Obviously, there's difference, and I get all you craft growers people. I'm not disputing the quality that can be achieved from small batch, like hand-watered organic, all the rest of it. But in terms of your general just... You should be able to get your pouch of weed. It's the, like I said, the branding and all of the extra steps that have been added to it feel like it's just veering away, because then every new person that comes into it, the money just veers it away from the planet, the people, the culture. Like these are the things that need to be considered. Otherwise, as I'm currently doing, we're not just fighting for like a liberalization here in the UK. We're having to fight against legalization. Because of what that would entail against us. It's not what people what we see over in the States. We're not going to have smoking. We're not going to have the kind of access. We can see that through the way that they've created the medical systems. And it just, I don't quite know how to get people back to realizing that. Do we need a major catastrophe? Do we, like, Fukushima happened, and the guy, one of the Japanese ministers, suggested growing cannabis, and he was laughed out of the room. Yet there is clear academic science that shows that cannabis is a bioremedial product that will remove irradiated materials. It's like they can't hear it. They don't want to hear it. They're ignorant to it. I said about the Upton Sinclair quote, I think, before we started recording, being that you can't expect a man to understand something when his salary is contingent on him not understanding. And I think a lot of the people who are in positions of power and decision makers, they're at odds with their paycheck.
Yeah. Or their position.
Which is probably why they're in that position. Yes.
But no, I truly get it. You know, this plant is the technology that we all wish for, but we can't manifest its access because it goes against everything that most governments today stand for.
Which, when you say it like that, kind of makes you ask what the hell they stand for. If the plant stands for humanity, for a fairer access, for wealth redistribution, I'm not talking about Robin Hood here, people. I'm just talking about the ability for people to grow their way out of poverty, or to just go, if I want to consume cannabis, to be able to grow enough that they need to consume, to not have to pay somebody else for the privilege. Like if you chose with a little bit of land to, again, grow your onions or potatoes, and you still go to the shop and buy potatoes. The potato companies are not rallying governments and lobbying them going, all these homegrown potatoes, they're ruining our industry. Do you know what I mean? It's they're not trying to ban mash, but you're allowed roasties, or you're allowed French fries, but not those steak cut chips. Do you know, that's as absurd as all of this feels to me. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah.
Well, most of those steak cut chips are made from whole potatoes, and many of the French fries are made from bits of potatoes and other things.
Yeah, exactly that. And that, again, I continue that analogy is perfect. It's the margin is what is need. They seek to maximize the margin over the commercial, the consumer experience, even the consequence to the environment. Because this is the big thing. All these companies going, oh, we're cannabis and we're a green company. And you're like, yeah, you guys are based in Israel and you're importing cannabis into the UK from fucking Zimbabwe. What's the carbon footprint on that, boys? Do you know what I mean? You're a company in this, and you're then buying it from here and going here, and it's again, it boggles the mind. They're negating, and they're going, yeah, but it's medicine, and we're helping, and they can sell and see just 1 degree of a 360. And like I said, it's so frustrating that we can't seem to employ somebody to stand in the middle of the circle and help direct, because otherwise, like we said, the Agricultural Act, I can't remember what it's full title is in America in 2018, the Farm Bill, I think it was colloquially termed.
Right.
The
The
consequences we're now seeing of that was, oh yeah, what was his name? Looks like a turtle. Jeff Sessions? Was it Jeff Sessions who
Oh
pushed
God,
that?
yes.
And yeah, and so he was like, oh, this is going to, like help get the industry off the ground, and it's going to revolutionize us, make us a powerhouse. And like 6 years later, and all of
Well,
this.
Jeff Sessions was the Attorney General. I think you're talking about Mitch McConnell
That's the one, Mitch McConnell. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Looks like a turtle, kind of
from
sounds like one
Kentucky.
too. Yeah.
Yes.
And the way that was championed in the language, and I was looking at it going, the fact that you're saying hemp and not cannabis, and you're going to artificially restrict it to this arbitrary percentage and all these other things, but then the language that was used was always going to go wrong. And like I said, now we're seeing, I can't remember which of the two states I just saw recently. I think maybe Alabama was just joined that list of states that are looking to ban hemp-derived cannabinoids like HHC, THCP, Delta-8, et cetera.
Florida is one of them.
Yeah, with Florida's quite interesting. So they've just put forward their recreational legislation again as well. And I think Florida's weird because it's in like 64%, I think it needs to pass by. And isn't, I'm sure that it was coupled with something, one of the abortion bills or something, or they did something where they've made it just, or they announced it basically in the same sentence as well, to make it extra contentious, because obviously Trulieve, one of the companies out in Florida, is a huge influence as an interstate player in America, and is growing its influence around the world. And it's, you know, that in the interstate power again. It's weird that you can't go and buy cannabis in from one state and go back to your state, but these big boys can set up these huge companies and have these giant grows and can influence, you know, so-called independent democracies of the states to follow suit because it benefits, you know, their product line or their bottom
Yeah.
line.
Control of supply chain and access and ability and commercial dominance.
Capitalists going to capitalize. This is the thing that frustrates me. I mean, Oregon,
Yes.
I don't know if where it was, I don't know if the bill got through to second reading, but it was in the lower house in Oregon, and they were talking 10 years in prison for growing over 100 cannabis plants. And obviously, Oregon have just gone back on decriminalization of small possession of all drugs. And so now they're, I think it's up to 180 days. I can't read that number in my head. A couple of $1,000 fine, I think, up to. And so it's minor in the grand scheme of things compared to where it was sort of was way back when. But there does seem to be these movements where the charge of the industry is putting off a lot of the states and a lot of regions and is causing conflict. I mean, we saw this when California sort of launched with Prop 64. Was it like half of what do you call them, the townships or the counties opted out, were just like, nah, dry county. And then they had to like onboard them over time.
Right.
And
Yeah. You know, to give the individual municipalities an opportunity to say, no, not here, it was a great disservice to the passing of the initiative that brought access initially in 20, well, in 1996. But as different versions of access and trying to commercialize something, because what happened with Proposition 215 back in 1996 is that it created a nonprofit scenario where everybody that was a co-op grower or seller was not paying taxes. So they had to figure out a way to tap into that revenue stream. And that's when, you know, the legal fuckery started. And how do we extract the dollars from, if you're calling something medical, you don't pay tax on it. You know, you don't pay tax on your food and you don't pay tax on medicine. But if it's cannabis, you got to pay tax on the sin of it. You know, because if, you know, during COVID, it was considered here in the U.S. A necessary product, you know, so all of the cannabis stores stayed open during COVID. You can go in and buy, your delivery services were open, and they were necessary, you know, accessible companies. And it was really because the states needed the tax revenue from the sale. So, you know, it went from something that was really beautiful and non-taxable, as it should be as a medicine, to you know, generally, you know, changing the narrative on and putting it to recreational. And if it's recreational, then you pay taxes on it because then you're not using it as medicine. But all cannabis use is medicinal. So, you know, how does your body tell you, you know, that, oh, I'm just using this for fun and excitement, as opposed to I'm using this for control of anxiety and stress and eating disorders or whatever? You know, your body is just using what it's taking in, just like food. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a medicine, it's medicine. If you're using it for, you know, God forbid that a medicine should actually make you feel good and alive and enjoy things and laugh and be able to eat and be able to share and be able to express and be able to create. God forbid that a medicine should do this. And if it does, then we need to tax it, because motherfuckers shouldn't be enjoying medicine. It should be painful. It should be it should be destructive. It should be life disrupting. You understand? I mean, the narrative around, you know, the access to cannabis and the terminology, like we were talking about between hemp and cannabis, or the continued use of the name marijuana. It's to separate. It's to give two sides. It's to be able to create a new narrative or a different narrative, or one that you can control and one that you need to regulate. And, you know, and there's all these different things that the access to cannabis has caused. And medicine is one of them. How can you tax a medicine? And there's all these medical markets that are paying tax. And that's because they truly don't believe about the medicine. They don't even care.
Yeah.
What they care about is the revenue that drug dealers used to get that they want to get now. Because if they put the drug dealers out of business, that means that that money should go to them. Mm-hmm. Because God damn it, they did their job.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They, like we said, since that kind of deregulation of neoliberal capitalism, the only crime is getting caught. Literally, one of the last things I can say this, because you've retired now, and actually I think I've already said this on the record anyway, one of the last things our chief constable said to me in the last meeting I had with him before he retired, he went, "Simba, you know, there is only one crime in this country, really, and that is getting caught." And I think when the business people get caught, oh, it's a need for regulatory change. You know, that there's a problem with the system. It wasn't the person. Oh, they were doing right. You know, they've made money. Whereas then on the flip side of that, like you said, the drug dealer, they've made money. That's bad. They've somehow done wrong. Yet it's the same thing. The only difference is the perception that is created by the input of the system that draws that arbitrary distinction between them. And I think what they're trying to do is almost dissolve that line and kind of go, well, do you boys know how to play? And I think the filter isn't race so much anymore as it is class and intention. Do you know, if you want to make all the money, well, you screw over your grand for that extra million. Yeah, you're one of us. Come join us. Do you know what I mean? And they're just kind of shopping around and building these new cliques and groups. And you can kind of see them at the different events around the world that you go to, of these suits and business people. Oh, we're part of this group. Oh, well, we're part of this investment. And they're all in their own little WhatsApp groups. They all have their own little meetings that they go to in different cities. And they're all went to the same schools. You know, they're all legacy money. Like, he's talking third, fourth, fifth generation money. Like, that kind of wealth is infiltrated into this, that the idea of cannabis as a medicine or a rec or whatever, like you said, the only consideration they give to it is the legally separation of it. So the only reason hemp still exists as a word and marijuana still exists as a word, we use skunk over here because marijuana never really picked up, but we use skunk to mean exactly the same thing. Consumers of cannabis that we don't like or are somehow attached to criminals, you know, often are ethnic minorities or foreigners or, you know, like say, yeah, lower class individuals. And they've managed to create this narrative in us that we go, oh, hemp. Hemp is the lovely one. That's all the hippies and they're the nice farmers and they're going to save the world.
That's not dangerous.
Yeah, and then CBD, that's all the fitness influencers and all the gym people and that's the nice cannabinoid. Then there's the recreational cannabis consumers and that's okay because people are allowed to drink alcohol, so they're okay as long as they're sensible and regulated and we know where they are and they're safe and we're recording how much they're consuming and how they're doing it. And then there's the marijuana or skunk user and they're the worst ones of all. Do you know what I mean? They grow it at home and they pay no tax, despite paying tax on their electric, on their feeds, on their water, on their seeds, on their nutrients, on their soils. They pay more tax than Google, than Amazon, than Microsoft, than Apple, anywhere basically in the world. Do you know what I mean? That's right. The irony of it. And it's, they should understand more money in our pockets means more money goes through their fucking systems. But in the UK, our high streets are decimated since fucking lockdowns because of stupid initiatives that we had of like eat out to help out and all this other stupid crap. That has just meant that there isn't the money. The majority of people don't have that little extra 20 quid you'd go buy that meal with. You'd go have that coffee with your mate down by the river. So everything is just crashing and depleting. And they don't seem to understand that if you put more money back into more hands, the system starts to become liquid again, starts to flow, the gears can start to merge, and that machine will work. It feels like genuinely they are, I don't know, in a financial death cult? Are they so, in a American psycho way, obsessed over their business cards and then little numbers that they will drive the world, not just economy, the physical world, humanity, off a cliff so that they have the bigger number? I swear to God, that's what it feels like.
You know, it could also be something like they figure if they extract the money, extort the money into their coffers, that's more money that they could use in order to create social programs that never really affect anybody. So the use of the, they're like, no, we're doing
the poor can't use that money. They'll do it
well-being.
Wrong. Yeah.
You know, I mean, imagine if all of those, you know, the drug lords and the mobs and all of the folks that have been running, you know, cannabis illegal for the last nearly 100 years, had they just paid taxes on the monies that they came, that came to them, would it still be the same? Mm-hmm. Or would they still look at it as, how dare somebody from their class, from their, you know, from where they came from, come up in stature and voice and power? You know, would they still try to put the foot on the neck? Mm. even if it was taxable? And that's pretty much what they're doing today in this space, is that, you know, the mom and pops, the legacy growers, the people that are within the space that are trying to build companies and raise communities and families, the foot of regulation and compliance exists whether they pay tax or not. And in fact, not only do they pay tax, they pay double and triple the tax just for the privilege of having the foot on that neck.
Yeah. Yeah. In my head, there's a BBC interview with George Orwell before he died. And he's asked, he's basically says, for a picture of the future of humanity, think of a boot on the neck of on the throat and the neck forever. And I think you could paraphrase that and say, think of the future of the cannabis industry. In the what bothers me, and it's probably because I'm neurodivergent and lies really bother me, but it's the gaslighting and the lying and the manipulation of it, of these people saying that they're doing all these wonderful things. And they're just not, they've co-opted the language. So they'll say, you know, social equity, inclusion, you know, diversity. They'll say these buzzwords and the things in their press statements, but it's token, it's gestural language. It's distracting kind of sound bites. So we go, oh, he said the words. It's like when Biden came out the other year and went, oh, we're going to deal with, you know, all federal convictions for cannabis on federal lands. And then you look at it, it's like, No fucker was pardoned. And then they come out again in the lead up to this election and go, oh, you know how we pardon thousands of people? We're going to do this thing again. And again, nothing happens.
Well, the fact is that they did pardon folks, but in federal prison, there is not a significant amount of people compared to state prisons. Even if those state prisons are funded by federal dollars or through state collections, more cannabis convictions and incarcerations are not in the federal penitentiaries, but in the state penitentiaries, which the federal government has no say in whether they become pardoned or released or,
It's because it basically, from my understanding, and I've been to America a couple of times, unless you're basically in a national park, in a state, you're not going to get charged under the federal statute, because states write in the superseding of state's law over federal, unless there's then aggravating factors for other crimes that then make it a federal offense. Otherwise, most things are dealt with under the statute and acts of that state. And so, it was just this thing. I'm quoting there, I think it was Beard Bros. It was, the first round of the thing I'm quoting initially, that, it would have pardoned people if there was anybody eligible, but ultimately because, as you say, the way the law works, and it's the same as they just kind of with the hemp thing of going, we're going to allow cannabis to become this industrial resource. And it's like, no, if you're saying less than 2%, 3%, even 1%, you are handicapping that plant massively, massively. The health of the plant of hemp is so much less than of cannabis. THC evolved, if we look at it from the Tibetan Plateau, seems to have evolved as effectively a UV. It helped, and a lot of the cannabinoids in the branch parts of the plant basically supplement the environment in which it was grown in. And then as we removed it from different environments, she's not had to express different aspects of this. And kind of, I'm going on a hemp rant, I'm sorry. But it's because of Grimm's Law. If you want to go into it, in Proto-Germanic language, in Grimm's Law, in the second, I can't remember what the hell the word is to describe it, of the phonetic changes of the Proto-German language, basically K's became H's. So cannabis and the canop and all of the Slavic and Russian and other words for cannabis that came from the Latin and the Greek, which that was K, and then through colloquial Latin, then becoming classic Latin, the K's became C's, which is how cannabis or cannabis became C, and then the V became as a B when it went into Europe, and then the K, it kept the K sound in the European pre-Germanic language, and then when it hit Germany, it brought the German region, it turned into Hanap, and then when the Brits got it from the Saxons, we got hemp. So Hanap, hemp, Hanap, all of them, it's all of those expressions of the word all have the same root in the etymology of cannabis from the Latin. And that's the thing that, again, bothers me, is that even since Carl Linnaeus in 1756, I'm still ranting, I'm sorry, Dan, he unified cannabis, obviously, under Cannabis sativa L. And there were three branch cannabis plants, a subgenus. There was Ruderalis, Cannabis sativa, and Cannabis indica. Obviously, we could argue, like, the Russians had, like, 13 cultivars, but, again, none of them were called hemp. I'm done. I'm sorry. I tried really hard. I got well over an hour before I did that. I'm sorry. But yeah, my point is that they only use that now. My only issue with the language is because they're using that against us. They're going, hemp is different to cannabis. And I see it, companies in this country, and they go, we produce our CBD from the hemp plant. And I just want to cry and scream or something, because it's like you are deliberately, either you are that stupid and you shouldn't be allowed a company, or you're trying to trick people. And you are, and by doing that, you are perpetuating the war on me and my friends and my community, because you're then profiteering from the perpetuation of prohibition by choosing to create a division in language that shouldn't exist. Which means when the law comes along and separates it in legalese terms, we then accept it and go, well, yeah, of course hemp should be this, and cannabis should be this, and synthetic should be this, and CBD should be. And I just feel like
it's pretty absurd.
And we're moving, like I said, we're moving further away. And yeah, I guess I don't know. I'm curious as to what, obviously, your dad tragically passed before I mean, there were movements in, like, there were things in Illinois in the 70s. There was, I'm trying to read a list in my head. There was several things around states where they tried to move some initiatives, very small initiatives. But basically, yeah, until Prop 215 and the cascade that then created in various regions, there wasn't really a conversation being had. And obviously, there's a famous interaction that I remember reading of between your dad and Dennis Perron about the conversation of 215 and whether it went far enough. And obviously Dennis was an advocate of all cannabis is, medicinal. And then sort of Jack arguing, well, how can hemp, as it were, in terms of the industrial applications, be medicinal? And I'm just interested as to what you think he would have thought if he could somehow just look at the industry today and, yeah, would he be happy with it? I guess I know there'd be certain aspects, but sort of overall,
Well, that's it's
is
a
it too big of a
multi.
question?
No, it's not so much that it's too big. From a position of access becoming more available, he would be happy. The fact that there are companies and people, individuals that are building companies, taking care of their families, creating commerce, these things he would be happy about, and there would be probably an "I told you so" there. On the regulation side, the way that governments are implementing access, my father would be just as vocal, if not more vocal, than he had ever been in his life. About the injustice of how do we create recreational freedom, medicinal freedom, but we still have incarceration and taking people's lives away, taking people's families away when they're in a dry area of the United States or anywhere else in the world that allows access and use, but still creates the potential of prosecution and incarceration for misusing it as they define. And I think that he would be extraordinarily vicious with regards to continuing the fight. The problem that we have as a society at the moment is that so many of the younger consumers, and I'm talking about, those that became of age shortly after Prop 215, through the development of social access, through co-ops and such here in the United States, and then through the medical spaces, is that many of them have grown up with access, and they didn't start their lives as advocates or activists, and they've just been consumers. So their consuming life has always been there as if it was their right, and don't understand that there was a fight that helped to create that. And they don't necessarily see the difference between, maybe some of the difficulties that they experience now with having to go through dry counties or still, leaving opportunities to be prosecuted. They don't look at it the same ways that my father and the Dennis Perrones and the Ed Adairs and the Steve D'Angelos and all of these folks that I grew up with, how they not only fought, they risked their freedoms to fight for this freedom. And so the younger generations are, they're posting on social media. They're developing companies that to them, for the most part, the cannabis is legal, but they don't understand that it's truly not. It is, we are being allowed access because we are paying for that access. We have paid access to cannabis. We don't have free access to cannabis. And in many places, you can't even grow cannabis and freely give it away. You can't share your cannabis. You can grow it for yourself, but you can't share it. You can't gift it. You can't this it. You can't, there's all of these different, and nothing matches. There's no consistency. There's no, there's nothing. So the voices of those who are now within the space that are becoming, mid 20s, early 30s, early 40 adults, are not the activists that the world needs right now in order to continue fighting. Now, it's not to say that they can't become it, because I believe that, you know, as the extortionary practices of state, local, and federal governments become more prevalent and more repressive, that those in the space will eventually stand back up and find their voices once again. I hope they read my father's book and realize that there is far more than just the consumption of cannabis that is the reason for the suppression of cannabis, and that it is so much more important than just the access to being able to smoke it. That is the future of what it is that we fought for to begin with. And once that realization, once that story becomes part of their lives, that maybe those voices will rise again. And that is my hope, is that, you know, there is that activist voice, not a politician's voice, not an appeasement voice, but one that truly activates the social needs of not, when I say community, the world, the cannabis community used to be my neighborhood in the San Fernando Valley. You know, that's how I grew up, you know, or whether it was in Thousand Oaks. But now the cannabis community is global. You know, the friends that I have in this space are in multiple countries. You know, the experiences that I have the ability to participate in are in multiple countries, you know, most recently, obviously, Germany, where, you know, we're going to be doing the Jack Herer Cup for the second time. And now in a post-legal Germany, which is going to be extraordinary in the middle of June of next month. And it's really important that people don't just look at what cannabis is and, you know, what the best of the flower is or the best concentrate, but, you know, where's the best intentions? Where are the loudest voices? Where are the voices that are still standing up for the fight that still needs to be had, and the fights that we're still going through? And, you know, we need to be more interactive within the space of continuing to educate one another on all of its possibilities, and unfortunately, including the possibility of still being incarcerated for it. And we need to fight for the alternative. You know, we need to fight for its freedom. We need to fight to not be incarcerated anywhere in the world for this plant. You know, we see bits and pieces of it, but they're more they're put in place right now more to subdue us from having the voice or needing the voice. Like, oh, Germany's becoming legal, we don't need to fight anymore. That's not the truth. Because now what Germany's going to do is they're going to realize that, you know, there's going to be all of these new things that are going to come about that maybe they didn't think about or didn't experience and hadn't witnessed. And then all of a sudden there's going to be, oh, well, there's going to be a change to the regulation. There's going to be a change to this. There's going to be a regulation on, you know, and the cycle will happen again, where the narrative will be, you know, fear and control rather than freedom and facts. And, the voice of this community still needs to find itself or reconnect with its roots, and let those who were the legacy folks, the founding fathers of the founding mothers of this space, you know, may their stories influence them to then hopefully find their voice and to become what it is that we continuously need in order to find a future with this plant. And I think that is, you know, as much as I enjoy these interactive shows where the cannabis community comes together by the thousands or tens of thousands and interact with one another and enjoy music and enjoy food and enjoy commerce and enjoy telling stories, there has to be a level of interaction and vocal contributions to restructure the narrative of who we are and what we truly represent, not just a commercial number of gross revenue in a market that is participating in the government's being able to build a new highway or fill a few potholes. Mm-hmm. But how do we build a new future? How do we expand a community? You know, those are the things that we need to find our voice in order to be a part of.
100%, man. 100%. So eloquently and well put. You just had some wonderful points there. I think pressure makes diamonds. And I think, as you say, the generation, I'm 36, I consider the generation beneath me. I mean, it's slightly different, obviously, here in UK and Europe, because obviously we haven't had the past 10 years plus kind of in the US where things have, there's been this potential, you know, all the states cascading to what are we on, 20 something now, rec states, 30.
More than 28.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Quite a few have stacked on it since last November. And the November before. But yeah, so this, they're living in this world where it's an inevitability to them almost. Like you say, there is no reason to fight. I said exactly the same thing. I know I take a lot of flack from my, I think it's like 3% now. I did lose a percent of my German listeners. Sorry, guys. I know I've spoke down on Germany recently, but it's only because I love you and I'm just trying to get you to understand exactly what Dan's just said there, which is the kind of literally what Dennis and Jack were having the debate about 215 is, does it go far enough? And yeah, you can say, oh, well, that's the little bit now, little victory. And yeah, they'll tweak it and they'll tweak it and they'll tweak it. But in what direction and who will benefit? And I think the difference now of the youth of where that Jack grew up in, you know, people like Emilia Jansen and that kind of generation of people that operated within kind of this space at all levels, their opposition was the prohibitionists in the state or the international governments, as it were, you know what I mean? And then there's this new enemy that's kind of there, and they hide in that culture and go, yeah, we want legalization. Yeah, yeah. And they're because they want to exploit the other people at that rally and go, yeah, we'll sell you the weed and it's going to be 50 quid an eighth, then 100 quid an eighth because of inflation. And then I'm going to charge you this and I'm going to charge you not. And so there's this new group of people. And so I've been saying it for 2 years now, folks. I'm anti-legalization. I'm pro-decriminalization and descheduling. Cannabis shouldn't be a scheduled drug. It's a plant. If you then want to schedule drugs, it should be Sativex, Nablolone, Epidiolex, the actual drugs derived from cannabis that are pharmaceuticalized products. But cannabis, in the language of it, it's a fucking plant. Do you know what I mean? We need to. That's what we should look at. I always use the analogy of homosexuality was criminalized here in the UK. Literally, you'd get chemically castrated and shit, and you could lawfully lose your job and be basically beaten by police, and many were, and there was an incredible amount of prejudice. Yet that was then legalized in the sense of the old parlance of legalized. They went and ripped up the law and went, you can't do that anymore. Granted, again, folks, there was a lot of bigotry, discrimination, homophobia in the UK. It still, frankly, is in a lot of places. But my point I'm trying to make is they didn't legislate that and go, you can hold hands between 7 and 7. You can kiss 3 times a day if you've got a license. Do you know, you can be gay in this area, but you're not allowed to be gay over there. None of that came into the equation. If it was wrong to discriminate against them because of their sexuality, their proclivities and their identity, how is that not a protected characteristic in cannabis? I know people say, oh, drugs are a choice. No, mate, I've been consuming cannabis for 20 years with my mental health and physical conditions. If I stop taking cannabis, my health goes off a fucking cliff. That isn't a choice. You don't then go to an asthmatic. Your asthma inhaler is a choice. You don't go to somebody that has uses crutches and go, those crutches are a choice. It's something an individual has found that betters their existence. And fuck you for trying to regulate it. Whether you be someone trying to profiteer from my existence or somebody trying to prohibit it, you don't belong in my life. The only conversation, if a conversation is worth having, is that we shouldn't be criminalizing anybody. If it can be accepted in any point as medicine, then it should all be medicine. If it can be accepted at any point as commerce, it should be commerce for all. Exactly this. This is why I always state that people like your dad and others, that when they said legalization, it was a different word to what is being used now. Legalization, as I call it, neo-legalization, because I love the prefixes to break up language because it helps define these things. is corporate legalization. It's exactly what you said. It's, yeah, there may have been some grassroots movements in Germany that were involved, but it was mainly the international cabal of corporates that moved that forward, that paid for the lobbyists. Like what's happening here in the UK, it's none of us a lot that are involved in lobbying. It's all the corporations, it's all the organizations, all the self-appointed regulators and governors of our industry. It's there aren't voices for us. I think, as you say, there needs to be this pressure for the youth to rise. I accept my position is I'm literally going, I've read Championed and was lucky enough to be alive, but quite small, when a lot of the big activism was happening in the world. I've learned that, I'm carrying the torch, and I'm going to pass it to the next gen because I understand. It's like the Israeli proverb. Probably isn't Israeli, but I'm not going to get into that. But plant date trees. Do you know what I mean? That we you do something that is for the next generation explicitly. You give up a part of your existence to better theirs. And I feel that the people above us that kind of screwed over, you know, the Jack Errors that screwed over, I'm going to list again for my legal protection anybody else that I'm thinking of right now, several other legacy individuals whose names have become bastardized in recent years, that's been sort of captured to Pied Piper us away from the idea of freedom and liberty, that it has stopped us from, well, we don't need to gather. We'll get together on 420 and we'll just have a big smoke. But none of us will get together and really understand the language and talk about that. Yeah, you're allowed to carry your 10 grams. You're allowed to carry 10 grams. Yeah, but why? Why can't we have 20? Why can't we have 25? Why can't we have 50? Why isn't there a limit at all? Why are you saying, oh, I'm allowed to grow two plants at home? Why are you saying it? Do you know what I'm saying? It's that's what activism is to me. This is the true civil disobedience. But it's the flame gets destroyed by the accelerant that is poured onto the corporate fire. So it looks vast and warm and inviting, and everybody glows around it. And there's a few activists, like you say, that are going, but we can have a better world. We could literally not have to have these carbon credits and all of this extra tax, and we could deal with this and this and this. And we have all of the an idea, like I said, a theory for the solution, but now more evidence of the science, like graphene batteries made from cannabis. And they're like, la, 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 la. But there is a few companies that now put money into that, and it is moving, but it's being so hidden. Yet every day, children are dying from mining lithium. It's like, I'm not seeing it. Oh, I can't see it. Where? I don't see it. It's not happening. I'm just going to go into the shop and buy my weed and pay my 30% tax. And then you've got driving home on your roads with your shit potholes. Like you said, they're like, where's then the money then going? If you could see it. Whereas I guarantee you, when Dave, your local Dave, used to buy your weed from, guess what Dave would do with your money? He'd pay for his kids' dinner. He'd pay his bills. That would then go into the local economy. Back in the day, as you said, there was a natural understanding, a sense of culture and community and heritage, because we were bonded by not being the oppressor. We were oppressed. So it didn't matter your proclivities or your other eccentricities. Were you cannabis? Yeah, cool, you're one of us. Don't be a dick. Come have a smoke. Do you know what I mean? Whereas that idea is so lost. Like I said, go to your average cannabis conference and try and smoke weed. Do you know what I mean? Stand up and see the giant signs. Cannabis is prohibited. You can't come and smoke. And then none of them consume cannabis. I'm not saying you have to consume cannabis. I'm just saying, if you don't listen to cannabis people when you're making these rules, you're going to do what Germany did and go 25 grams. When, again, we buy in 28s. It just feels like they've deliberately done it. You're not allowed to smoke cannabis in most public areas until 7 p.m. at night. Again, 420. I feel like they just haven't taken into consideration us, or the opposite, they have, and they're trying to undercut the culture and go, oh, well, we're doing this to get rid of dealing so the street dealers are not selling ounces. But then if it's in 25s, that means you're not going to be buying quarters or eighths or halves. Again, these are units of measure that, despite the evolution of the standardization of metric from imperial, that's an identifier. So we all joke when we say, like, what's 1/8 of? You know, there's all the memes and everything. We have all of this heritage that I feel that this neo-legalization is, like you say, it's plastering over, and it's becoming global, because you see it lands in a country and, oh, this country has just announced that they're going to legalize the industrial applications and medical use of cannabis. It's always the same script. And then it's the same companies. Oh, it's Curaleaf are going to be importing. Oh, do you know what I mean? It's the same people, it feels, and none of them are our people. And I'm not saying it should be this such a divisive thing. Like I said, I believe that we could synergistically develop a better world together. I don't know business. I don't know how to make quarterly profits go up. I don't know how to deal with, you know, your HR resolution issues or what. I don't know any of that. But you know, fucking weed. You've got your cannabis company, you've got all this stuff. And you see it in the States. I mean, look at the stocks on any cannabis company anywhere in the world. Do you know what I mean? In the pump and dump. And you go, there isn't the confidence. There isn't the belief in these things. And most people you speak to off the record, or that I speak to off the record, we won't be here in 2 years, 5 years. Their intention is to get bought up, to get conglomerated, to get made into one of five.
Pardon me.
What part of one of five groups that own the world? Do you know what I mean? It's they're waiting for their paycheck and they get all of the spots. They're on the news whenever we're talking about it. They're writing the big articles. They get the big features. They're the key speakers, expos. Do you know what I mean?
And like control you said, and supply. Those are the two important things.
Man, and they're efficient. They're fucking efficient. I'll give them that. All right, let's do a few quick fires and then I'll let you go because I'm aware of the time. I was reading something quite interesting that I hadn't seen before, but it was something that I looked at when I was just kind of just searching around the internet for general notes. I saw an article about your dad claiming that he used or credited, amongst other things, Amanita muscaria as helping recover from his heart attack and stroke. And it just got me thinking, Jack is obviously exceptionally famous for cannabis. I'm just wondering, obviously, in the 70s, 60s, if he got turned on to weed in the 1969. Obviously, I'm not asking you to dob your dad in or anything. Yeah, I'm just wondering if there was... Did he have a psychedelic side or a streak in him? Is that something that continued across the family?
In the last 20 years of his life, I would say, maybe even since the 80s, he did quite a bit of acid and especially mushrooms after his stroke in 2000. It took quite a long time. Several years after his stroke for him to start regaining more understandable speech. It was a long, slow process. He credits the mushrooms. I'm not so sure that it wasn't just, you know, general rehabilitation, but there were some things that were greatly improved, like after 2005, 2006, his speech became more controlled and fluent and less frustrating. And that was just a few years after, you know, a fairly massive stroke in 2000, which unfortunately robbed him of his ability to communicate that he, you know, the way that he had, you know, the 30 years prior. And it was good to be able to hear him again prior to his passing in 2010. But he certainly believed that the use and consumption of a significant amount of mushrooms benefited him, if not at the very least emotionally, and helped to deal with the stress and complexity of the personal limitations that he had those last, you know, 9 years. Yeah. So
yeah, wow, thank you for
I don't have a magical answer for that.
No, that's you've answered my question. That was the insight sort of I was sort of was hoping for in a way. It's something I can empathize. I talk a lot, as you probably noticed, even just spending a couple of hours with me here, Dan. And I can't imagine, especially if I have my little wins here and there, But to have then be held in such esteem as he was before, and to, again, people go and look at any speeches, just Google and look at some shit and watch the way that he spoke, to then lose that capability you spoke of there with that frustration, I think, yeah, I mean, again, I'm quite well-versed with things like I took a lot of acid for quite a long time, did a documentary with BBC about acid. And yeah, the peace that that would bring to for that loss of communication, it's quite a lonely thing. So I can see, and almost then being able to come to terms with that in itself, I think, if nothing else, is probably what allowed his body to almost heal from it, rather than having this constant tension and pressure of like, why can't I need, I want, I need, you know, to get that validation, that cessation of that need to feel heard. So I can, yeah, I can understand that. I can understand that.
Yeah, his voice was quite prolific. And if any of you that are watching this have the ability to go on YouTube and look up Jack Herer and listen to him speak, you'll hear the passion, you'll hear the purpose in his voice. You'll hear him growl, you might hear him laugh, but you'll understand the level of passion and dedication and love that he had for this community, for this plant, and the vision of the opportunities that it could bring. And many of them are becoming a reality, mm-hmm. for good or bad, whether they're, you know, when here in the United States, there's a very large, gathering every year called MJ BizCon in Las Vegas. And, you know, even though it's very corporate and it's, you know, very well funded, and, you know, there's, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that are generated from it, when you go in and you look at the size of the facility and the amount of people that attend it, the folks that are dedicating their lives and investing their time and energy to develop new products, new processes, new ways of using or process, you know, just when you see that the industrial engine of what is happening nationally and internationally there at this event, and you see these, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, you know that the voice that he had, that he shared, that he inspired, is experienced there on that floor, where people are still dedicating their lives to this plant and to its possibilities. And even with the corporate structure aside, I still feel the community there, or at least the intent of it. And I'm always hopeful that that'll become more, it'll become more standardized, you know, like these events will happen on a global scale, not just the Vegas market, you know, but that everywhere, whether it's the UK, whether it's Germany, whether it's Spain or Portugal or, you know, Indonesia, anywhere where there's the use and the love of this plant, that the industry can come together and really shine. I mean, maybe that's a fantasy because, you know, it takes such massive corporate dollars in order for that to exist. And most cannabis is not really corporatized because it's not really legal. Mm. You know, we're still at a paid access level, not necessarily a legal, and let's really develop a true industry. Even though the volume of money that comes from this is staggering, and, you know, when people talk about the billions of dollars that are going into California or Colorado or Michigan or New York or New Jersey or any place else around the United States or around the world that is embracing access and potential supply chains to cannabis, you know, the legacy part of cannabis is not necessarily competing at the highest levels. They're being invited into the corporate suites, but not from a control standpoint. We just become, useful pawns in trying to change the narrative of corporate greed into, hey, we represent the legacy. We have, so-and-so as part of our company, they're trying to change the narrative from being, corporate robots and controllers to, hey, we're really part of your community. And I hope that that narrative changes. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, I don't hold a lot of hope out for the corporate community, but I have a lot of faith in the cannabis community.
No, yeah, I think I would agree with that. I think you're onto something there, and I think it's not naive, or I can't remember the adjective you used to describe it. Of you to think that there is that culture there, even at MJ BizCon, which represents, the pinnacle of the capitalist intention with cannabis, in that huge expo center just off the strip in Las Vegas. It's a very poignant event, as you say, but I think everybody believes themselves to be the protagonist of their own narrative. Everybody, Jeffrey Dahmer was sat going, decapitating that guy. That was, in some way, he justified that shit. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, everybody does. Nobody didn't choose to go, I'm going to do something really bad that I disagree with. Do you know what I mean? It's just not how the human brain works. That isn't to justify anybody in anything. What I'm saying is that everyone in that room believes they're doing good. Even the ones that we would identify and go, you are actually here. Here's the data. You are causing harm. They'll be like, no, you don't understand, though. In the end, once my company gets big enough and I pay for this and we do this, and it just seems to miss it. I feel that the effort isn't one man or woman or person is going to push this across the line. It's all of us. I'm not saying, and I'm still trying to work this out in my own brain of how it works, that there has to be no participation for there to be change. It's not like a boycott, because that's not going to get us anywhere really in the grand scheme of things. And it's not then getting talk and gestures of, oh, they give us $5,000 and we're going to use that for this, when you give them like 100,000 grand's worth of fucking free advertising without even thinking about it. Like, they have a different worldview, as you say, that they can affect this narrative. And I think so many people are caught up in that. I don't think everybody in the corporate cannabis space is a bad person. I want to clarify that from my comments over the past few hours, guys. But I do think that it's what we've spoke of in the past, of wetico, which is a word from Native American culture, of like this cannibalizing, greedy impulse, this kind of sickness that infects man, that then you take and then get one more and more. And it's the billionaire sat there going, I've got three, but if I have four, oh, five though, if I have 5 billion, do you know what I mean? It's that. And they can justify all of that without ever realizing that because they've got 5 billion hidden in a room somewhere, millions of people don't have money. It's a finite systems, and it's until there is this true, like say, grassroots movement. And I think to answer your earlier question of where are they, social media suppression. It's all, I say this, look at my numbers, folks. You know what I mean? I struggle. I've been fighting with Google AdSense for 3 years. I am inappropriate content and will not be monetized. Just won't be. It's not going to happen. And
well, listen, yeah. I hate to interrupt. I have a hard stop. I have a conference call. We can come back to this because I'm super engaged. But I have a hard stop right now. If you've got one final question that we can answer, I'd be down for that.
Yeah, what I'll do then? Yeah, we'll wrap it up.
Or I can call back in the next half hour or so after I get through this phone call, and we can finish this up.
I'll tell you what, I've got something booked in about 45 minutes. So what I will do is if we sort of wrap this for now, and we'll call this a part one, as it were, and I'll invite you back on in, I don't know, maybe a month or two. And we'll discuss some things, or maybe actually we'll give it a couple of months, because I think there might be some news that would be fresh to add, although I might get my time scale wrong there. But yeah,
all right, brother.
I'll ask you my final cliche question that I ask everybody. Although this will be kind of short for next time anyway. And that is, what does the future hold for you?
Hope.
That's probably the best answer I've had to that question. I've asked it 140 odd times, and that's an answer, brother. Then that is a beautiful way to end this. I know it's a bit quick, but like I said, we'll get you back on. Well, that's the answer.
Thank you so much.
I've
I really
enjoyed this.
Appreciate the time you've given me today.
Likewise, brother, likewise. We'll get you back on again soon. And yeah, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
All the best.
Be well.
Peace and love, brother. Well, there you go, folks. That was Dan Herra, son of the legendary Jack Herra. I do apologize that that sort of abruptly came to an end there, folks. I think I miscalculated my time zone changes there. I thought I had another hour with Dan. I think I may have screwed up the time zone difference. We were rambling. I was rambling quite a lot before we started recording as well. So I think I maybe thought that we had a bit more time than we actually did there. But yeah, as you saw at the end, we will make an excuse to get Dan back on the podcast before too long, some point over the, we're still early in the spring, probably later in the spring or maybe early summer. I need to look at schedule. We do have some other returning guests soon. I got some new guests coming up as well. And I'm, as always, contacting very ambitious guests and trying to convince people to come and spend a couple of hours. I was going to say getting high with me or watching me get high and answering my questions for a couple of hours. But yeah, do want to say a massive thank you again to Dan for taking the time. Really, really enjoyed the conversation. Looking forward to a part two and to covering a few more of the questions and topics that I've kind of had on my notes here that I wanted to discuss with him. But I think we covered quite a lot of good ground there. I thought that we answered some of, at least for me personally, I got some of the questions answered that I've kind of always had. More, I guess, as a fanboy moment of his dad. Again, not to say that I don't appreciate Dan and his work and what he's been up to. We didn't get onto as much of that as I would have liked, but hopefully in the next visit we will get round to that. Just want to say a massive thank you to you as well. If you listen to all of this, if you did it all in one go, you trooper, greatly appreciate you. Thank you very much. So yeah, if you enjoyed this, folks, please do give us a like, a share, a rating, a subscribe, a star, a thumbs up, whatever it is you do on whatever platform it is that you're consuming this podcast on. I appreciate it and you. If you really, really enjoy this podcast too, and this project of mine in general, please do check us out on patreon.com/thesimplelife, where for less than a cup of coffee a week, you can help me keep the lights on this project of mine. Check out thesimplelife.com for further details, more blogs and info, articles, etc. I will be releasing a new article about Durham 420 soon. I'm just trying to get ahead on some projects that I'm working on at the minute, cross some T's, dot some I's, ducks in a row and all that jazz. All right, we will be back next week with somebody. It'll be awesome. All right, be good to each other. I'll see you later. Peace and love, folks.